The next case on our calendar is 05797, Brian Byrd versus Glenn Smith. Mr. Rosenhofer.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I am here on behalf of the appellants, Brian and Tammy Byrd. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The certified question is very narrowly drafted, and the proposition that we tender to the court is likewise narrowly drafted, and that is whether an opponent may offer a contradictory or inconsistent affidavit to a trial court at the time of summary judgment, and in fact, if one does so, whether the court has to, in fact, consider that affidavit. With that said, I believe that this court has perhaps hinted at where it might land on this question in a case cited within one of the cases that both Mr. Hanoski and I cite to you, and that is the Barreal versus East End Land Development Company. Cited therein is Bowen versus Kilcare, a 1991 submitted and 1992 decided case where factually it's significant. Mr. Bowen was the plaintiff appellant, and he made deposition testimony that was inconsistent with a later submitted affidavit for purposes of summary judgment. The majority of this court indicated that, in fact, the trial court erred in not considering that affidavit for purposes of summary judgment. With that said, having narrowly drafted our proposition of law consistent with the certified question, the dissent might add a little language to the proposition in that the dissent indicates that the majority's position is appropriate with the caveat that there should be some explanation as to why there is a difference in inconsistency or how the affidavit supplements the summary judgment issue.
Counsel, in this case, the original information was that he was not at work at the time of the accident, correct? That was the original position.
He was not at work, that's correct.
The subsequent, was it a deposition or affidavit? The subsequent affidavit?
Well, the deposition indicated that he was given the regular use of the motor vehicle.
Okay, so there was a subsequent deposition. We're talking about what was the subsequent piece of evidence, a deposition or an affidavit?
The deposition was in May of 2001, and the affidavit was at summary judgment in 2004.
Okay. In that second piece of evidence, he maintained that he had a pager, and he was on 24-hour call, and he drove a car with the information about the company on the car. Now, those are not necessarily inconsistent, are they?
They are not inconsistent.
And the court could still find summary judgment in favor of the company because nowhere do I see in either piece of information any testimony that, while those things may all be true, that he was actually answering a call or he was actually had been paged or he was actually doing anything business-wise. And so to really get to the place you want us to be, you have to find that somebody who's on call automatically gets 24-hour coverage from the company, even if they may be on personal errands when they're on call.
I'll try to directly answer your question. I don't believe that's true, because the narrow proposition that we have is whether a non-moving party's affidavit can create issues of fact. With that, we seem to come full circle back to Galatas, and with that, the issue of fact is whether one who carries a pager 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, drives a company truck with signage on it that obviously potentially betters the company's position by advertising, whether they in fact may be in the scope and course of employment.
So do we really have a situation where we have an inconsistent affidavit and deposition? Because they don't seem to be inconsistent. What we do have is whether the rule of Galatas applies to that fact situation.
That's correct. And as Your Honor has gotten us home to Galatas, it seems that we can't avoid it. Syllabus 2 says whether one is in the scope or course of employment becomes the issue for UM coverage, and whether one is in the course and scope of employment under this court's precedent is always an issue of fact for a trier of fact under the facts and circumstances of this case.
So is this case truly in conflict with cases where there is a direct contradiction, I was, and then the second one said I wasn't, whereas this is simply an expansion to which we now need to apply a rule of law? I mean, I guess I'm not seeing a real conflict because I don't see this as being an actual contradiction.
I think there are two, perhaps three characters of affidavits we're talking about, one of which is contradictory to a prior sworn statement. That sworn statement may or may not be a deposition. It could be testimony in a criminal case. One is where there's perhaps an inconsistency in the affidavit, and then in this instance, there's something supplemental to what the deponent's testimony was. And it's important in this instance that we understand that it's supplemental because the deposition is taken in May of 2001, as you know, was purely for coverage issues because of Scott Ponser.
Do you agree that a truly contradictory affidavit and deposition, if you have a true contradiction, that it's a good rule of law to say that that can't defeat summary judgment because anybody could file one just to get past summary?
I would absolutely agree with you. That walks a very bad line for every lawyer. I see Mr. Coughlin here, and the DR says we can't proffer something like that to a court. And we also know what happens with a grand jury and the affiant who does that.
So we may not really have a conflict here if we accept your proposition. It's just simply a question of whether Gladys applies to a 24-hour call.
I believe that the issue that was tendered to you is the conflict issue, and I believe the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 6th, and 8th districts are aligned with the proposition as tendered by the Byrds. The balance of the districts do not.
The legal issue seems to go beyond the facts in this case, does it not? I mean, it's a legal issue that it would seem to me we could decide without considering what the implications are for the case, since it's a certified conflict. Does that make any sense?
It does to me, Your Honor, in the sense that it's a very narrow issue. Its impact is very major because we obviously have a policy of the law that disputes should be resolved on the merits. And as we do the research on these cases, we find the legions of cases go all over. And in fact, I think in the Second Circuit, or Second District, I came across two cases that are that go different ways on the same fact pattern. Whether a non-moving party may submit by way of supplemental or contradictory affidavit issues of fact that create that overcome
thereby creating the issue that needs to go to beyond summary judgment. Really, that's the issue, is it not?
Pardon me.
Can the affidavit that conflicts with deposition testimony create a material issue of fact that then defeats the motion for summary judgment? That's the legal issue, is it not, that we need to decide?
That's the legal issue. Yeah. That's the proposition.
Because it might, obviously, it's arisen in other courts, so that's the importance of the case, I guess.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I think
how do you see Turner impacting this? I'm over here. How do you see Turner impacting this, which was a case that involved the moving party creating an issue?
Justice O'Donnell, I would indicate to you that maybe there's a distinction without a difference whether it's a moving or non-moving party.
Does Turner control this case from your vantage point?
No. It's factually and legally different. Clearly, Turner was a moving party who then gave an affidavit that conflicted with a deposition, which
yes.
is always going to create a credibility question. Is there a credibility question present in this case? I would submit no, because this affidavit is supplemental, because the information in the affidavit was never developed in a deposition.
Do we want non-moving parties to be able to create issues of fact, and would that not be the end of summary judgment every time a party thought it was an appropriate summary judgment situation based on all the evidence presented and submitted the motion? A contradictory affidavit comes out by the non-moving party?
I would submit to you that this would not be the death of summary judgment. What it I'll give you a rather classic analogy. And so somewhere in this state, probably as we stand here, some witness has been sworn in a traffic case, and the question is asked, was the light red? And the witness says no, and that's where it's left. So the defense lawyer for the person that is sued then gets a transcript of that testimony and says, well, you testified in your sworn testimony in the criminal case, the traffic case, that the light wasn't red. That's right. With that said, nobody asked me whether it was yellow or whether it was green or whether I had a left turn arrow. That information would be supplemental, not contradictory. If that witness said consistent with that in this whatever kind of case, that
so
yes,
counsel,
that's
counsel, would the introduction then on a summary judgment motion, the introduction of a affidavit by the non-moving party creating an issue of fact require a hearing at that point before the judge to determine, number one, was the affidavit made in good faith, and number two, is it supplemental as opposed to contradictory? And if it is merely supplemental, then it would be allowed and create an issue of fact.
Would it require a hearing? I would say that every summary judgment by rule, there is
no, maybe another aspect to the summary judgment hearing, which would be for the court to determine, for want of a better word, the validity or the good faith characteristics of the affidavit.
And certainly some of the cases speak specifically as to whether make a good faith
right,
type
I understand
of analysis.
That's
does it require a separate hearing? I
or
I would
part
say
of the
no.
summary judgment hearing is the quality of the affidavit. Compare the affidavit to the deposition. If it is supplemental, continuous, as opposed to contradictory. And if it was contradictory, it would be deemed self-serving for the purposes of creating a conflict, and summary judgment, provided all things else were there, would be awarded to the moving party.
I would agree with
you.
So
there's a workable scenario that can come out of a rule that this court might make.
That's correct. And I think the court, again, hints at that rule in Bowen versus Kilcare. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenhofer. Mr. Kanowski.
Counsel, before you start, would you address that scenario and question I just put to opposing counsel?
Absolutely, Justice O'Connor. I don't think a hearing is required. I think it would be a good idea under some circumstances. However, in other circumstances, where you have clear deposition testimony on a specific factual issue, which is unequivocal, where the deposition was ordered and transcribed, was submitted to the witness for review and signature pursuant to Rule 30, where no changes were made under the errata sheet pursuant to Rule 30E, which allows grammatical and substantive changes to deposition testimony, provided that reasons are given for the change, provided that that occurs with no changes being made, a summary judgment motion is then filed maybe some months down the road, a year down the road, and then in response to the motion, there is an affidavit submitted that does nothing more than in a mere conclusory fashion contradict the sworn deposition testimony that the witness said under oath. Their attorney didn't ask them any questions at the deposition. They didn't change the testimony through an errata sheet. And it's clear from the face of the affidavit that the only reason it is being submitted is to overcome summary judgment. Under those circumstances, I'm not sure a hearing is necessarily required to make that determination. Could a trial judge do that? Yes, it would be permissible. Rule 56G discusses bad faith affidavits. Mm-hmm. And it's under those circumstances, a bad faith affidavit, cost can be awarded, a contempt finding can be made.
I understand that. Now, let me follow up then. If the affidavit and all things happen with the deposition that you outlined, and the affidavit is supplemental, for clarification, does not contradict, that it expands and is signed and presented. Would you agree that that would create an issue of fact and defeat the summary judgment? And keep in mind that the affidavit is obviously provided by the non-moving party.
It could. Presumably, it's a self-serving affidavit. There is case law in this state from our appellate districts that say a self-serving affidavit, which is unsupported by any Rule 56 materials in and of itself, cannot create a genuine issue of material fact. However, if it's truly supplemental, I believe that it could create a genuine issue of material fact, but that analysis still has to go forward.
I understand that. So there's no automatic that the non-moving party in a summary judgment motion files an affidavit and automatically it's excluded, it's not considered by the court, et cetera. You don't believe that that should be a rule?
I do not. Okay. I do embrace a bright line rule, however, consistent, I believe, with the appellate districts in this state, consistent with every federal circuit court, consistent with most other state courts, that a contradictory affidavit submitted in opposition to a motion for summary judgment, which is contradictory, clearly contradictory, to prior sworn deposition testimony, should be disregarded.
Counsel, using your standard that you just gave us, in this particular case, how do you analyze what was offered by the non-moving party here?
And I think that's what Justice Stratton was discussing earlier. In other words, do we have a conflict? Really, do we have a truly contradictory affidavit? I would agree there are some averments in the affidavit of Mr. Byrd, which were supplemental to his deposition. There was also an averment in his affidavit, I think it was the last averment, which says as far as he was concerned, he was in the course and scope of his employment. That conclusion, if you will, was clearly contradictory, in my view, to his deposition testimony. And even beyond that, if you go back and look at the complaint that was filed in this case, the initial complaint, it is not even alleged in the complaint that Mr. Byrd was in the course and scope of his employment. So he files a lawsuit naming tortfeasor and insurance carriers, does not allege he's in the course and scope of his employment. He is deposed. He testifies during a series of pages that he was essentially running a personal errand in a company-owned vehicle. He was picking up a car part.
Counsel,
and taking it.
Isn't that the essence of Scott Ponser? He didn't need to be at work. He didn't need to state in his pleadings at that time that he was in the course and scope of his business or employment. So we can't fault him for that.
I'm not necessarily faulting him. However, the conclusion in the affidavit that says, as far as he was concerned, he was in the course and scope of his employment.
But just because it was not in his pleadings, there's no contradiction there.
I think that issue is debatable. And it wasn't something, if you look back at the trial court and court of appeals, that we strongly embrace, that this affidavit was a classic affidavit that was contradictory to a certain point, i.e. red light, now green light, i.e. there's nothing on the floor at deposition. An affidavit, oh, there was a puddle of water.
Well, counsel,
it's not that case.
It seems that the final part of his affidavit is really the ultimate conclusion of law in the case. But what is supplemental about it would seem to be that he's getting facts in that set up an alternative claim for coverage within the parameters of the coverage that would still be left under Gladys, that is the signage issue. So his affidavit would be supplemental, I think that would be the fair word to describe, in respect to now laying down in the case there's signage, and the other part of his affidavit simply, it's almost a legal argument. He's telling the judge this is why signage is important. That still means because I'm driving it around, that's within the scope of employment. But that's ultimately a conclusion that has to be a legal conclusion, does it not?
I would agree. We're not here, may I remind the court, on a discretionary appeal. We're here solely, right. Which was denied, we're here solely on a certified conflict question. And I would agree, this isn't the classic case of a contradictory affidavit that we see in literally hundreds of cases.
So both of you agree that if, to the extent there's a supplemental information provided in an affidavit by the non-moving party, that is something that is required to be considered by the court before granting summary.
Considered, whether it creates a genuine issue of material fact is another issue.
But the rule that it sounds like you're pretty close together on what the rule is that we should be writing in terms of this case.
I think that we do embrace basically the same rule. Our briefs are consistent with that. The only decision before this court in crafting this rule of law, which is extremely important because this issue comes up from a practitioner standpoint all the time. And even though there, in my view, a clear line of appellate authority in this state that says that you can't do it, that you can't change your testimony to defeat summary judgment, it still happens all the time. And we still have appellate decision after appellate decision saying that that's not true.
Isn't it risky for counsel to submit a client to submit an affidavit that's inconsistent with the deposition if the case goes to trial? I mean, opposing counsel can present the inconsistency, can't he or she, and then doesn't that then raise a credibility issue with the jury as a finder of fact?
I think there's clearly a credibility issue created under those circumstances. I think that it is different than the Turner decision where this court expressed that with regard to a movant who submits an affidavit contradictory to deposition, a credibility issue is created.
That's an easier case.
That is easier, but I think it's consistent. The rule of law we're embracing here today or suggesting is consistent with Turner, and that is at its core that a party or a litigant should not benefit either in obtaining summary judgment or defeating summary judgment through a contradictory affidavit to prior sworn deposition testimony. And clearly there's a credibility issue created, but with regard to a non-movement, there is such a credibility issue created, but it does not raise to the level of a genuine issue of material fact. And to become a genuine issue, as this court has noted previously, there must be some weighing of evidence by the trial judge to determine the validity of the evidence.
Would it be helpful, because I think what I'm focusing in on is, would it be helpful to, in this test that we create, to clarify what are factual supplements versus a legal conclusion? In this case, you had factual supplements, which I don't see as contradictory at all, but then you have this legal conclusion thrown in, which they are trying to throw in to defeat summary judgment, and we could say a court is free to look at the facts that supplement, but ignore legal conclusions, because that's really the province of the court or the jury if it does create the facts, create an issue of fact. But putting a legal conclusion in that may create a different scenario doesn't defeat the summary judgment, because that's not the province of what the evidence for summary judgment is.
I would agree with that, and I believe there's other factors this court should consider.
What would you
address.
Think the rule of law should be in this instance?
The rule of law, I believe, should be bright line. I believe it should be a mandatory rule. I believe that it should state that a party who submits a contradictory affidavit to prior sworn deposition testimony cannot obtain summary judgment through that contradictory affidavit and cannot defeat summary judgment through that contradictory affidavit.
Does that belong as part of the civil rule then, amendment on summary judgment, or does that flow out as a decision of response to the certified question in this case?
I believe it responds to the certified question because the certified conflict question has two interesting words in it from my view. It says, is it proper for courts to disregard a contradictory affidavit? Proper or mandatory? Is there discretion there? I believe it should be mandatory. And disregard, that suggests that it's never even viewed, looked at, considered. I don't think in practicality that's true because the court has to look at it, first of all, to see if it's contradictory.
Well, I guess that's what I was asking you. Wouldn't it be better to take a look at an amendment to the rule so that this would become more broadly applied, as opposed to trying to tie it to the facts of answering the specific question given to us with these facts and this wording.
I think it's something that the Rules Committee should certainly consider. I think, however, that it goes in large part to the summary judgment standards and reciprocal burdens that have come out through decisional law. Because what we're really getting to the heart of is what is a genuine issue of material fact versus what the federal courts would call it, a sham issue. And it's a sham issue if there's a self-serving affidavit submitted for no other reason than to defeat summary judgment. And I think that that ties in perfectly with what our courts have said regarding what summary judgment is, the burdens.
What you're telling us is that after we go through the Drescher versus Burt scenario and we complete our discovery and we get to the crucial point of the motion being submitted, here comes a contrary affidavit and we start all over again.
Usually at that stage, discovery is closed. Usually at that stage, the movement has met their burden of proof, their moving burden, and it's now in the hands of the non-moving burden, or non-movement, to overcome that burden. And what happens, unfortunately, too often than it should, is a contradictory affidavit is submitted only to defeat summary judgment.
I guess that's the key. I guess if you want a bright line, the premise has to be for it has to be that the sham occurs so frequently that we should stop the sham. Do we have any empirical, any data that indicates how often this is done? I think it's risky. Seems to me it would be risky for a lawyer to do that, because if a case goes to trial, then you've got two conflicting statements from one of the parties. And maybe that's not, it would seem to be a problem to me, but maybe it isn't.
In terms of the frequency, I can submit to you that there are hundreds of appellate decisions in Ohio addressing this issue. I would submit to you that there's an ALR drafted under the federal, basically discussing the federal rule and the uniformity of it, with thousands of decisions from the circuits addressing this issue. It happens too often than not, and the practical effect of it is that the parties go through discovery, you take depositions, They're transcribed, no changes are made within the prescribed time, discovery closes, the lawyers, parties spend all kinds of money taking these depositions, drafting motions for summary judgment, and then there's this affidavit that's generated that at least within one appellate district in our state, the third district, can overcome summary judgment. Mm-hmm. And so the parties, basically under those circumstances, you can't rely on a deposition. I submit that you should be able to rely on a deposition taken under oath. It is to be conducted as though at trial by examination and cross-examination, and when no changes are made substantively through the errata sheet.
Well, but when you get to trial, a deposition doesn't rise to that level. If the witness is there, you can use it to impeach, to cross-examine, and all of that, but the jury has to sort out, you know, what do we believe, the live testimony or what this person said earlier in a deposition? And even sometimes there may be a credible and plausible explanation for why the testimony at trial is different than the deposition.
I think the depositions are different than affidavits. They are more reliable information. They, under many circumstances, can be admitted at trial as evidence. Affidavits never can be. And when changes are made on an errata sheet and that deposition is submitted at trial, by rule, the changes from the errata sheet must be admitted into evidence.
So if the non-moving party has a change of mind as to something they said on deposition when it pops up filed in summary, the proper course for the lawyer representing that person would then be to take another deposition?
I suppose that would be a procedure. What I believe the
and
proper
that would be that would have a different standing than an affidavit.
I don't know if it would, because there are decisions which suggest that subsequent evidence, contradictory in nature with no explanation at all, is nothing more than a sham. Because that procedure would be only done in a way to circumvent what the witness said. I believe that the only opportunity to change that testimony is specified by a rule. And that's the unique thing about a deposition compared to live trial testimony, is that the witness does have an opportunity to review and change. And once that window closes, we should be able to rely on the testimony.
If we accept the way you have worded the proposition, in effect, we would be strengthening Civil Rule 56, would we not?
You would be strengthening it, and I would suggest giving it more professionalism and making the practice of discovery and depositions and filing and moving mm-hmm. for summary judgment more meaningful. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanowski. Mr. Rosenhofer, you've saved about 2.5 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. There are a couple observations, and I'll address Justice Pfeiffer first. The word sham's awfully strong. I believe that if you get to the point of a sham, you're going to have one very angry trial judge who's probably going to send a letter to the local grievance committee, and he's also probably going to refer the matter to the grand jury. That has happened in the true sham situation.
What about suspect? Affidavits are suspect.
I don't know how to answer that question.
The trial judge has the discretion to decide whether it's a sham, whether it's offered.
Offered in good faith
or not.
Good faith, and that's the term of art used in a lot of the decisions. Now, with that said, obviously, I think that there's an agreement here that what happened with Brian Bird, simply because of the nature of the proceedings, was his affidavit is supplemental. Clearly, the deposition in May of 2001, the limitation was to coverage issues only. It was at the request of the defense counsel to find other coverage. They were looking for other pockets. And we had agreed, and it's replete in the transcript. Where I'm heading here is that Bowen versus Kilcare, the majority opinion, sets forth a relatively bright line test, and then the minority, the dissent, sets up what I would perceive to be, or what many writers, or what you'll find in the cases, is an addition to the proposition that the appellants have tendered, and that is that an inconsistent or supplemental as affidavit is so long as there's an explanation apparent, either in the affidavit or in the record as to why the affidavit is being submitted. That's why I submit that the court has probably tread on this issue in Bowen versus Kilcare, and I believe that when you take the majority with the dissent, you probably end up where most of the writers are ending up on this, including those things that Mr. Hanowski and I have jointly read.
Counsel,
I thank you.
Yes, could I just ask, the proposition was stated, as a party who submits a contradictory affidavit cannot obtain or defeat summary judgment. Do you have problems with that proposition as stated?
That should be the law in this state.
I think
that's clear. Then perhaps a second syllabus that where one offers a supplemental or explains an inconsistent prior statement, then that the court must consider that for purposes of summary judgment. That's why we've addressed a very narrow certified question.
It seems it really needs to be explained both in the positive and in the negative.
That's my perception, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenhofer.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.